As in,
some different people,
here.
Some people, even though they can.
It's boring anymore.
He's in Cincinnati, so we never go down there.
I see the 8th District.
Is in pretty good shape outside of that?
Okay.
The office?
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It's August 28th, 2013, and we'll hold off on approval of the minutes because we don't have a quorum yet to vote. So let's start then with, and I understand number two on the agenda is being carried over until tomorrow. Okay, so why don't we go to just follow the agenda from there. Number three on the agenda, and we're looking at post-retirement adjustment mechanisms. And Mr. Martin, do you want to start us off?
Members, I'll just make a brief comment. Mr. Burek is going to do the bulk of the post-retirement. Historically, what the staff has done when we've done interim studies is, especially if the we expect that the consideration of the topic will take more than a single meeting, the initial staff memo is mostly an aggregation of a lot of information that relates to the topic, to try and give you some baseline understanding of the topic all in one place. And so this first consideration of this topic will be largely a historical exercise and a descriptive exercise and not a whole lot of policy analysis at this point. At this time, I'll turn it over to Mr. Burek.
Mr. Burek.
Members, you have a memo in your packet titled "Review of Current Current Post-Retirement Adjustments," and I also cover adjustments that have been used in the past in this particular memo. In order to put the post-retirement adjustment mechanisms in some context, we begin by indicating what the Commission standard has been. That's what it's done on the first page, the purpose of post-retirement adjustments. And what I indicate there is that the purpose and standard of the Commission has changed over time. In the early 1950s, early 1960s, basically the early years of the Commission, the Commission and legislature occasionally granted adjustments to retirees. Clearly, this was motivated by a perceived need to alleviate harm. But there was no really clear standard regarding what the size of those adjustments should be, what the purpose of the adjustments should be, other than to provide some assistance. And the early Commission documents indicate that although there was this perceived need, the Commission and the legislature was quite concerned about the liabilities that might be created. And they felt that any adjustments that were provided should be provided on an ad hoc basis and should be considered as a gratuity or assistance rather than any sort of pension right. I have a quote there from the 1961 version of the principles dealing with post-retirement adjustments, and it indicates that any increases in pension benefits, in other words, post-retirement adjustments, provided to retired individuals should be considered as assistance and not disguised as pensions. Such grants should in all cases be separately financed and never charged to the pension funds. By the mid to late 1970s, that notion had been considerably transformed and has actually changed very little since the mid-1970s, beyond getting a little more specific. By the mid-70s, there was a clear understanding of a need to provide assistance to retirees in order to adjust those benefits to keep them whole. And as I say, it's been refined a bit over time, but really has not changed. The current version of the Commission's principles includes this statement regarding post-retirement increases. It states that retirement benefits should be increased during the period of retirement to offset inflation in order to maintain a retirement benefit that was adequate at the time of retirement. This system of post-retirement adjustments should be funded actuarially. What has happened is that the commission has adopted certain standards, one of which is that benefits should be adequate at the time of retirement, adequate for an employee who has provided considerable service in the public sector, generally 30 years or more. Individuals who have provided less service, of course, should get lesser benefits, but presumably there is a need there as well to try to keep those benefits whole. So in addition to providing an adequate benefit at the time of retirement, the commission standard indicates that benefit that was adequate at the time of retirement needs to be adjusted so that it remains adequate. And the only way to do that and meet that standard is to provide adjustments that match inflation. The standards also indicate that these increases should be funded on an actuarial basis. Now, since the obligations of our pension plans are funded on an actuarial basis, it made sense that post-retirement adjustments should also be funded within the pension plans themselves, and that has, in fact, become the accepted norm. So that's the standard. Basically, the commission standard is that once retirees begin receiving benefits, the benefits should be adjusted to match inflation. From there, I begin a history of the adjustments that have been, types of adjustments that have been provided in Minnesota public pension plans, and then an overview of the current adjustments. That overview of past adjustments starts on page 2, continues for several pages. Rather than cover the details for each of the systems verbally, I'll leave it to members to dig into details there as they so desire. Instead of covering the details, let me just cover the types of systems that have been used, give some examples, basically working from that list that's shown on the top of page 2. The first type of adjustments that were provided by Minnesota pension plans were ad hoc adjustments, meaning they were occasional adjustments, not predictable adjustments, and serve the purpose of providing some relief. That was the standard practice through the 50s, part of the 60s. Then it became understood that something more predictable with a clearer purpose needed to be provided. And the ad hoc adjustments for the first-class city teacher plans were revised from being occasional ad hoc to use of a 13th check. The 13th check was also used by Minneapolis police, Minneapolis fire plans. But since those plans no longer exist, I focused on the Duluth and St. Paul teacher plans, the two first-class city plans that still exist. Now, a 13th check provision is nothing more than an additional check. The individuals receive 12 checks, one each month, and then there might be an additional check, and hence the name 13th check. Now, the way the 13th check worked was there was some triggering event, and the triggering event that was used was investment returns that were in excess of the plan's actuarial interest assumption, basically a return in excess of 5%. If there was a return in excess of that actuarial assumption, then the plan was authorized to distribute a small portion of the pension plan assets to the retirees in the form of an additional 13th check, in other words, an additional help. Now, given that the triggering event occurred, then we had to have a system for distributing it among the available retirees. And the process that was used there was for one of these plans, solely the number of years of service credit. The total years of service credit from all the available recipients was added up. That and the total available assets created a unit value. Then that unit value was distributed based on, again, the number of years of service credit. So individuals would receive the computed unit value times the amount of service credit that they had. Now, the other plan used a slightly different system. It distributed based on the number of years of service credit and the number of years in retirement. With that system, there was some increase in that benefit that was paid the longer an individual was retired. So it perhaps matched a little bit better the effects of some sort of inflation adjustment, but it was at best a very, very crude approximation. One thing I should also point out about that is that since the allocation was strictly based on service credit or service credit plus years of, in retirement, depending on the plan, it didn't depend at all upon what the individual's actual benefit was. So an individual who may have been a fairly low-paid teacher with, say, 30 years of service credit would receive the same adjustment under this plan as a higher-paid administrator also with 30 years of service. So it did not match in any way the notion that inflation affects us all and that the best way to adjust benefits was to provide everyone with a percentage increase in retirement that, in was based on that
I have a good question for you.
Thank you.
You're saying, though, that it was still a percentage of whatever they were getting. It wasn't like a flat rate, so they were all getting the same thing. They were getting whatever percentage
it wasn't,
of their...
It wasn't a percentage.
Oh, it wasn't.
It was...
flat rate.
Given the amount that was allocated, given the allocation procedure, the individual received that particular dollar amount.
Thank you.
It wasn't a rate, again, because it really didn't depend on the initial benefit. The next type of adjustment that I'll mention is fixed percentage adjustment plus an excess investment return related percentage adjustment. This is a system that was, again, used by the First Class City Teacher Plans. This followed the use of the 13th check, following the repeal of 13th check provisions. The way this system basically operated was the systems provided fixed percentage adjustments in this case. And the automatic adjustment, I believe, if memory serves me right, was an automatic 2% adjustment. And then the retirees might also receive additional percentage adjustments based on excess investment returns in excess of the actuarial interest rate assumption. The actuarial interest rate assumption at the time was 8.5%. So if the five-year annualized return, which was a form of five-year average return, if that was in excess of 8.5%, then the individuals would receive an additional adjustment above and beyond the automatic 2%. So if there was 3% in excess return, the individuals would receive a 3% plus the automatic 2% or a 5% adjustment in that particular year. The adjustment used at the time by MSRS, Minnesota State Retirement System, PARA, Public Employees Retirement Association, and TRA, differed somewhat. And that system was, at least in its later forms, an inflation match that was capped originally at 3.5%, plus possible percentage adjustments based on excess reserves. Not excess return, although one certainly has a tendency to affect the other. And it's a very important distinction, as I'll it should become clear shortly. Basically, the way this system operated was the rate of return, the inflation rate would be determined for the year. That would be matched up to the 3.5% cap. And then the State Board of Investment, which was operating the post fund, which was the fund for which this procedure was used, would determine whether there were excess reserves. Now, to determine whether there was excess reserves, basically the system was when individuals retired, the full reserves needed to pay the pension for that retiree transferred to the post-retirement fund. So initially we had this stream of assets coming into the post fund with fully funded reserves. Now, if the return was equal to the actuarial assumed return, that would provide sufficient assets to cover the investment match and no excess. But if there were if the rates of return were greater than that, then that would generate additional asset value. The additional asset value would generate excess reserves, basically additional assets above and beyond that currently needed to sustain the level of benefits at that time. And then it was determined just what sort of an increase could be provided based on those reserves. That was described in percentage terms, and individuals in the post fund would receive the inflation match up to 3.5% plus this additional adjustment. Now, this system bears a superficial similarity to the system that was used by Duluth, St. Paul, and also Minneapolis teachers at the time. The Minneapolis teachers, Duluth, St. Paul plans were basing this additional return based on excess rates of return above 8.5%, whereas the post fund, basically the retirees of the MSRS para and TRA plans, were basing any additional excess beyond the inflation match based on whether there were excess reserves. Where this really mattered was if, say, there had been a period, perhaps a prolonged period, or maybe a very quick reversal in the investment markets, which considerably reduced the assets in the post fund. Suddenly, the post fund could have gone from being fully funded to a situation where the assets in the post fund were, in fact, not adequate to fully cover the promised levels of benefits. Then we might have a period of very good investment returns. These good investment returns would begin building up the reserves in the post fund, but no additional adjustments could be paid until the necessary reserves met the 100% requirement and went beyond that. In contrast with the system that was used by the First Quest City teacher plans, as soon as we had a 5-year rate of return, which was in excess of 8.5, the system would begin generating additional increases. Basically, the spigot would get turned back on. And that could happen quite quickly. The assets of the particular pension plan could have gotten substantially depleted. What you need is several years of very strong returns in order to begin building that up. But because of the 5-year averaging, if you had, say, 1 year where due to a major recovery you suddenly had a 20% rate of return, that 5-year average could very quickly become an average which exceeded the 8.5, and the spigot would get turned back on well before the pension fund had generated sufficient assets to really support that system. Basically, the system that was used by the First Quest City teacher plans was not tied to assets at all. It was based solely on the rate of return. So if, for example, if you had a pension plan that was literally circling the drain, had just a few thousand dollars of assets left, but the rate of return on those assets was very, very high, then the system would say, well, we have to generate considerable additional post-retirement increases for the retirees. But clearly, in that situation, the pension plan simply doesn't have the assets to do it. This system did considerable harm to the first-class city teacher plans, very serious harm to Minneapolis teachers and, frankly, considerable harm to the other two. What happened to the Minneapolis teachers plan was that it got to the point where the total assets of the pension plan were less than the reserves that were needed to back up the retirees of the plan. And once a pension plan using this kind of a post-retirement system gets to that point, some very unusual things happen. The first thing that happens is no matter how successful that pension plan was, there was no longer any way for that pension plan to build up its assets in order to become more stable. Basically, any investment returns, any assets related to those investment returns simply began flowing out to the retirees. So once that point was reached where the assets were no longer sufficient to fully cover the liabilities of the retirees, the pension plan would enter a death spiral unless there was a major influx of assets from some other source, from state aid, whatever. So that system used by the first-class city teacher plans was seriously flawed in its design. The post fund, the system that was used by MSRS, PERA, and TRA, was also a flawed approach, but at least it had one advantage in that the spigot didn't get turned on quite as quickly following the return of more successful investment markets. But one chief disadvantage of the post fund, and this was shared by the system used by the first-class city teacher plans, was there's no reason to believe that the increases that were generated by the systems in any way matched inflation. And what happened, particularly during the 1990s, is that all these systems were generating increases that were considerably in excess of inflation. Now, the system that was used by first-class city teacher plans and the post fund were eventually eliminated from statute, in part, certainly directly so, for the post fund, due to the funding ratio of the post fund. In 2008, legislation was passed relating to the post fund, stating that if the funding ratio of the post fund dropped below 80%, the post fund would be dissolved. The assets of the retirees that had been in the post fund would flow back into the plan for the active employees. Basically, they would be recombined. And PERA, TRA, and MSRS would begin paying a flat 2.5 percentage adjustment instead of whatever had been promised under the post fund. A few years later, and there may have been a year or two of these flat 2.5% adjustments, but a few years later in 2010, the administrators for the pension plans, MSRS, PERA, TRA, and first-class city teacher plans, came to the legislature with proposals to considerably revise the pension plans, part of which included proposals to adjust the post-retirement adjustment mechanisms used by these plans. These were generally referred to as the financial stability measures, and they passed as Article 1 of the Commission's omnibus bill in that year, 2010. What was called for in that 2010 legislation, for many of the plans, MSRS, PARA, TRA, were lower percentage adjustments than had been put in place in 2008. So adjustments lower than the 2.5% adjustments. But these adjustments could increase over time if certain funding ratios were met. Basically, for most of these plans, these were used as triggers. For the First Class City Teacher plans, benefit increases were considerably scaled back. Duluth, initially, there would be no increases provided for the Duluth plan until its funding reached, I believe it was at least 80%, although these have been changed in the last year or two. And for the Duluth and St. Paul plans, eventually, when funding stability returns, those plans will pay a capped inflation match, not to exceed 5%. Now, in the next few pages are the details of the specific types of adjustments over time used by each of these plans. I'll skip that and move, since I've covered it in a general fashion already, I'll skip that and move right to Table 1, which appears on page 7. And this is a summary of the current post-retirement adjustment mechanisms used by all these plans. This is the result of the 2010 legislation, which is also tinkered with some more in 2011, 2012, 2013. So this now is a snapshot of the current situation. What should be immediately obvious is that there is, well, a near total lack of uniformity here. Up until 2010, the commissions had, for many, many years, been striving to achieve consistent procedures, consistent treatment of similar retirees and similar plans. The plans were generally grouped into two categories. One was general employee plans, and that included the teacher plans, TRA, First Class City Teacher plans, and also the individuals in the general employee plans within MSRS and PARA. And the other category was the public safety plans, basically the MSRS State Patrol plan and the PARA Police and Fire plan. And the commissions, as I said, for many decades had been moving closer and closer towards uniform treatment within the general employee plans and the public safety plans. In 2010, there was a major reversal, and in large part, this was due to the fact that the revised procedures were developed almost entirely by the pension plan administrations themselves without much input revision by the pension commission. The pension commission at the time basically took the position that the pension plans were in a serious situation because of the great recession that had begun in 2008. Commission recognized that, and if the pension plan administrations were able to put together proposals that had the backing of the constituent groups that they represented, Commission felt that was the best way to go. The problem, though, is that the pension plans, the constituent groups, don't share the same principles that the pension commission did, the principles of consistent treatment among plans. Basically, the individual plan systems were motivated primarily by certainly the need to address the immediate situation and also just to keep peace among the folks back home, basically keep peace in house. So the systems that were proposed and eventually passed tended to point in many different directions. They weren't consistent even within plan systems and certainly not consistent across plans. They did, however, have a certain general outline. The general concept was that there would be much lower benefits initially, and those are covered sort of in the middle of that middle rows of that table. I have information there on the provisions that will apply until funding stability is before funding stability is achieved. The bottom portion is provisions that will occur after funding stability is achieved. And then there was a definition of funding stability, and that's described at the very top of that page. And the definition of funding stability would define the point at which we would move from the reduced benefits that had been now put in place to the higher benefits. Now, if we look at the definition of funding stability, what is immediately apparent is the lack of consistency. Some of the plans are using the funding stability funding ratio, and these are all the definition of funding stability was all defined in terms of funding ratios. But some of the plans, MSRS, PARA, TRA, at least as it now stands, are all basing those ratios on the market value of assets. St. Paul teachers and Duluth teachers, on the other hand, are using ratios based on the actuarial value of assets. Now, that's of some significance because as investment markets have improved, market value of the plan will begin to increase, and a funding ratio based on market value is likely to be met quicker than one based on actuarial value. And that's because the actuarial value of assets was intended as a smoothing mechanism. It blends a few years. So it will be slower to recover than the market value. So there is a meaningful difference then between the use of a funding ratio based on market value and a funding ratio based on actuarial value in terms of how prompt the change will be. Also, some of these are used as triggers. In other words, once this funding ratio is achieved, at that point we will move to higher post-retirement adjustments and never revert back. In other situations, in particular the PARA plans, PARA General and Correctional and PARA Police and Fire, these funding ratios aren't used as triggers but rather as permanent requirements. If our funding ratio is within this range, we will pay this benefit. If it's within this range, we will pay a different benefit. And if the funding ratio if it reverts to lower amounts over time, then we have to go back again to paying the lesser benefits. So it's a permanent requirement. It's not a one-time hurdle. Also, some of the plans have a single trigger. MSRS General, MSRS Correctional, legislators, legislative officers. TRA, whereas the MSRS Judges Plan, MSRS State Patrol Plan have two triggers. A first trigger to allow you to pay slightly better benefits, a second trigger to allow you to move to yet a third stage. The St. Paul Teachers Plan, in contrast, has what I for lack of a better term, decided to call two standards. It's not really a permanent requirement because it's sort of a temporary requirement, and hence a standard or temporary standard. With the St. Paul plan, there are two standards, a certain level of benefits payable when funding ratios are below a certain level, somewhat higher benefits when the funding ratio is between that level and a certain higher level. And if we revert back because the funding ratio is lower in a future year, then we have to go back to paying lower benefits. So in that sense, it's a requirement rather than a one-time standard. But once the St. Paul plan reaches a 90% funding ratio, again, based on actuarial value, then those standards are repealed. And from that date forward, the St. Paul plan will begin paying an inflation match up to 5%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
So Mr. Burke, you said that. So even if that fund level goes below the 90%, 80, 70, 60, after that, they still stick with the?
Yes. Okay. Now, the Duluth plan, and this is due to 2013 legislation, which most recently revised the system that they were using. The Duluth plan has a single trigger. And again, it's a trigger, not a standard, but a single trigger. And basically, once 90% funding is reached in that plan, again, based on actuarial value rather than market value, it will begin paying a 5% match to inflation. That plan has a blink-off provision, where St. Paul does not. If the Duluth funding ratio falls below 80%, all adjustments for the Duluth plan shut off. So it's sort of like St. Paul, except St. Paul doesn't have the blink-off provision, whereas Duluth does. The next rows further down describe the waiting periods and the benefits paid when each of the plans mentioned above are in a situation where funding stability has not been achieved. Now, you'll notice the full adjustment, and that means the full adjustment for an individual who is entitled to a full adjustment rather than a very recent retiree. First thing to mention is that the full adjustments vary considerably across plans. Some of the MSRS plans are 2%, but the MSRS judges, MSRS State Patrol plan can be as low as 1.5%. Para plans are 1%. TRA is 2%. St. Paul teachers will provide a 1% adjustment of somewhat higher funding ratios. They will provide a 2% adjustment. Duluth is at 1%. So, again, it's immediately evident that the retirees across these systems will be treated in different ways depending upon which plan is providing the coverage. Regarding the minimum period for full benefit adjustment, there are differences there. MSRS plans generally 18 months. Para will provide a full adjustment at 12 months, but the para adjustment is only 1% rather than 2%. So the fact that individuals are receiving a full adjustment somewhat quicker may not help them all that much. The minimum periods for adjustments, 6 months in the MSRS plans, as well as 1 month in para, para general, para correctional. But the real outlier there, well, two outliers here. The first one I'll mention is para police and fire. And again, this is due to 2013 legislation particular to this plan. The legislation that passed last year created a very long waiting period for the first adjustment, whether it's a partial adjustment or a complete adjustment. individuals retiring from parapolice and fire, at least those who retire after mid-2014, will have to wait 25 months to receive a partial adjustment and a full 36 months or 3 years before they receive their first full adjustment. And that first full adjustment would only be a 1% increase in any case. The other outlier I would mention is the Duluth teacher plans. Again, due to legislation passed last year, there was no provisions in that legislation to pay any sort of benefit for those who have been retired a portion of a year rather than a full year. So there's no prorated adjustment. If the individual was not retired at least a year, the retired Duluth teacher would receive no adjustment. So there's a lot of a considerable lack of similarity here, and the chief concern would be those plans where there is the longest delay, notably parapolice and fire plan. Retirees are bound to be vulnerable in these systems if inflation becomes considerably higher than it is right now. The paraplegic and fire retirees would be in a particularly difficult situation that they would have to wait 3 years to receive the first adjustment, and a 1% adjustment could be well below what prevailing inflation rates are. The bottom portion is if funding stability is achieved. So these are the provisions that will apply once a plan gets to the funding stability funding ratio. Most of the plans for a full adjustment, you have to be retired 12 months or 1 year. Paraplegic and fire, though, it would remain at 3 years, 36 months. The full adjustment amount is, again, not uniform. The MSRS plans would be 2.5%. TRA would be 2.5%. Parageneral correctional are 2.5%. The outlier within para, again, though, is the para police and fire plan. The 2013 legislation called for an inflation match not to exceed 2.5%. So even after funding stability is reached, the retirees in the paraplegic and fire plan would lag behind in terms of adjustments. The retirees from the other para plans and from MSRS and TRA. The other MSRS para TRA plans, those retirees would be receiving 2.5% every year. Paraplegic and fire would receive at most 2.5%, and at times they would receive less. So they would clearly begin to lag behind. St. Paul teachers, Duluth teachers, again, have that inflation match not to exceed 5%, although the Duluth inflation match could blink off if the funding ratio there falls below 80% again. So two things to come away with from this. First is that there is considerable lack of uniformity due to what happened in 2010 and later legislation, which represents a considerable departure from the direction that previous commissions had been heading. The second thing I would mention is that none of these systems, whether any of the past systems that I've summarized or the systems that are now in place or will be in place once funding stability is achieved, is fully consistent with the Commission's policy statement. To be fully consistent, they'd have to be providing an inflation match, period. Whereas the only systems that are even considering an inflation match are the paraplegic and fire, the first-class city teacher plans, but those are all capped provisions. So if inflation were in excess of 2.5% for paraplegic fire or in excess of 5% for those first capacity teacher plans, because of that cap, those groups would begin to fall behind. I guess I could mention, add one more comment on the 2.5% adjustments that most of the MSRS plans and TRA and para general and correctional will eventually begin to pay once funding stability is reached. That's the 2.5% adjustment. If my memory serves me right, and it really does these days, back in 2008, when the 2.5 fixed adjustment was first eventually put into law, the plan administrators testified that they felt 2.5% was a reasonable approximation of inflation over the long term. So it's maybe it is a proxy for an inflation match. But again, it is at best a proxy, and it falls short of what is required by the commission statement, and it will result in some people maybe being kept whole, while others not, depending upon when they retire and what's happening with inflation over their remaining lifetimes.
Mr. Burek, in the past, have we had a floating inflation? In other words, to be consistent with the principles that the post-retirement adjustment should be inflation, then wouldn't it have to float? Doesn't the commission usually?
It would match whatever the inflation rate was.
That's so it would be changing.
What would be needed, yes. If the inflation rate in the prior year was 3%, the post-retirement adjustment would be 3%. If it were 1%, post-retirement adjustment that year, the following year would be 1%.
Do the plans have the authority to do a floating inflation, or would we have to give them that authority, or do we set the inflation?
This all has to be specified in law. Okay. And law right now definitely does not authorize them to do that.
But if we did specify it in law, we'd give the authority. I'm just saying if we follow that approach, which you said is consistent with the principles, then we wouldn't. The legislature would say it's a floating inflation based, basically, and give the authority to the pension boards, the individual plans.
Right.
That would be one approach.
I mean, the legislation would indicate that, you know, for the following plans, the post-retirement adjustment will match inflation, and then
inflation.
The based administration of that, I'm sure, could be detailed in the law, but the pension plans or SBI, perhaps, would be charged with looking up, basically determining what the inflation rate was, and then the applicable pension plans would begin to pay that adjustment to the individuals.
And have we ever done it that way?
No. When the in the latter days of the post fund, there was part of the system where amounts generated by the post fund. Part of it was an inflation match up to, initially it was up to 3.5%, then it was up to, I believe, 1997, it was changed up to 2.5%. But that's, again, it's a capped inflation match, similar to the notion that you have in current law, eventually becoming effective for para police and fire, and for the St. Paul and Duluth teacher plans. Those plans would eventually get to a capped inflation match, but there is no plan where law provides that they will eventually move to an uncapped inflation match.
Madam Chair, if you could look on the last page of the memo, page 12, that's a history of both inflation and post-retirement increases from 1978 through 2013, the first column next to the years is the CPI. Mm. And if you run just quickly down that listing, in many years it's relatively consistent, but there are times when it bounces considerably. And that bounce is a lot of actuarial cost when it goes up to 7, 9, 11% to replace the entirety of that rate of inflation would be considerably costly.
If inflation's that high.
Yes. And that's like the reason why there have been caps, 70s, 80s. Is to protect the actuarial soundness of the pension funds, because a promise that isn't backed by sound assets is no promise at all.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Burke.
I just wanted to mention the need for a correction in the table, and that is under the state patrol plan, in the middle rows there, the full adjustment says up to 70% ratio based on market value at 1.5% return. The 70% should be 85%, and similarly, the line just below it, the 70% should be 85%. Just wanted to make that correction.
What page is this?
That's page 7.
Oh, page 7. I'm looking on the wrong table.
Table that I've been.
And under the State Patrol plan, you said?
Right.
In the middle?
In the rows in the middle, dealing with the situation when funding stability has not been achieved. The full adjustment there, it says that up to a 70% ratio based on market value, the adjustment will be 1.5%. And it should be, instead of 70%, it should be read 85%. And similarly, the line just below it should read 85% rather than 70%.
Any questions from members of the commission? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Burke, you talked about plans coming up with their own is there any responsibility from the state to oversee that and see to it that that does not happen, or that there be some sort of
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, members, the commission and the legislature create the laws. What happened back in 2008 was that the 2010 was that the at a time when major changes were being proposed by the pension plan systems, the commission decided to basically accept those, basically defer to the pension plan administrations. I assume because the constituents covered by the pension plans had bought into these proposals, were willing to support them, and the commission and legislature felt, well, maybe we shouldn't upset the apple cart. If this looks like it'll get the job done, if the groups are buying into it, then let's do it. But what happened, again, was because of the parochial interest of the plans, the plan administrators, the solutions didn't have the same focus, the same underlying objectives that are stated in the commission principles and had been directing prior commissions. And so we wound up with solutions, as summarized in Table 1 here, that were just pointing in many, many different directions. Rather than a single way to address a problem, there are several ways. There's no notion here of, well, what's a best practice? Let's figure out what the best practice is and let's do it. Instead, we've got some systems using triggers, one trigger, others using two triggers, others using permanent requirements rather than triggers, others with standards that eventually will be repealed when certain funding ratios are met, and benefit levels that are not consistent across the plans. Now, regarding the post-retirement adjustments that aren't consistent across the plans, now, regarding the level of these adjustments, one of the things that was driving the lack of consistency here was that, well, all plans were in trouble, but some plans were in more trouble than the others. And so the feeling probably was, well, we want to give something to retirees, but we can't be as generous as the other MSRS plans are, or as TRA is, whatever. And in part that follows from the fact that given that we have so many individual little funds, as each plan administration looks at what's going on with its individual little fund, it's got to come up with a solution that makes sense within that context. There could have been more uniformity, frankly, if some of these were merged. There are differences between TRA and first-class city teachers, in large part because first-class city teacher plans were in worse condition than TRA. One way to ensure more uniformity would have been to put these all under one roof, put them all under one fund, and then what is appropriate, what is a good solution for that fund, would follow for all teachers, regardless of where in the state you are.
And there is a study going on about merging the Duluth and St. Paul Teachers Plan into TRA, and we'll be getting a preliminary report this fall on how that study's going.
And same arguments could be made for the public safety plans. We have a small public safety plan in MSRS. We have a somewhat larger public safety plan in PARA. One's covering public safety officers at the state level, one's covering public safety officers in local and community environments, but they're all public safety. Certainly an argument for treating all of them comparably, and we were quite close to that leading into 2010, but the resulting legislation, again, moved in very different directions.
Any other questions from members of the commission? Senator Goodwin, did you?
Oh, thank you. I think Senator Murphy had her Representative Murphy had her hand up first.
I'm going to step out for a minute. After we do questions, can you just, I'll give this to Alice.
Sure.
Can you just ask the plan directors if they want to comment?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burke. This is really helpful for me. I'm learning a lot that I'd forgotten over the years. I'm wondering if you are going to talk about the difference between the employee and employer deductions for the pension plans, and two things, if that's going to, if we're going to see all the different amounts that are collected, and if that has anything to do with differences in the inflationary, amounts that they get or changes in their benefits as they go along.
Members, I didn't include that because it doesn't relate directly to post-retirement adjustments, but that is another area where, frankly, historically, there have been considerable differences. Again, it's related to the size of the pots and the fact that we have several different funds rather than a larger fund covering all similar employees. Whenever you have smaller funds, certain differences in the demographics, for instance, are going to show up. Differences in turnover, for instance. And as a result of that, the contribution requirements for the plans, these separate little plans, may differ from one another, even though they're promising the same benefits at retirement. And as a result of the differences in contribution requirements, also as a result of different levels of unfunded liability in the plans, which you're also trying to cover through the contribution requirements, you wind up with different contribution requirements specified for these plans. And so you wind up with, well, it's another area where there are differences.
Mr. Martin,
I'm sorry.
In your packets, you have a folder that's labeled standard packet items. And if you can grab that and find the item that is printed on blue paper, it should be a manila folder.
Looking at,
standard packet items.
Yes.
And in that, there's an item that's on blue paper. Yeah. Dig down a couple. And then if you flip that to page two, you start to get the individual plan by plan detail, which includes the member contributions and employer contributions down towards the bottom of the page. So if you and if you page back enough, you get we group these by the general employee pension plans, the public safety type plans, the specialty plans, and the teacher plans. So you get a sense where you can correlate some of what you're learning in the memo that Mr. Burek just went through with your question about how contribution rates differ by just putting these two side by side. And looking at the table on page 7 of Mr. Burek's memo, which talked about differences in post-retirement increases, and we can look at the applicable pension plan to get a sense of the...
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have just one quick follow-up question.
Good one.
Is there any information in here that compares the deficiencies in the funds, you know, not only as they are now, but as they've been over time, and how much the state has put into these funds to try to cover those deficiencies in the different plans? That would be helpful, I think, just so we kind of know what funds have kind of consistently had issues.
The page that you grabbed, which was on a legal-sized piece of paper,
okay,
is as close as we've got to that, okay. Which gives you the short piece of the letter-sized is the condition, the 2012 condition of the pension funds. The long paper version is 2012 compared with 2011 and gives you a sense of... you flip to page probably the best place to start. You flip to page 5 of the long paper item, and Senator Goodwin, you're on the short paper. If you look on page 5, for instance, the legal sized sheet. What you have there is column by column, two columns for MSRS General, two columns for PERA, two columns for TRA, and it compares the 2012 actual evaluation results with 2011. And the deficiency, the contribution shortfall, if there is one, is the very last number on the page. You can compare how that has changed over this one-year period of time. We have... additional charts like this that go back that can give you the actuarial work comparatively back to the 1950s. We can either put those in your packets or you also can get it on the Pension Commission website. They're available there and under the actuarial valuations tab on the Commission website.
Thank you.
So we have the information. That's as much of it you have in your regular packet.
And the individual plans, they also could give you kind of the funding history. Like, and relatively recently, many of these funds were fully funded at 100%, and then we had the stock market difficulties. I would be interested in hearing from the... Representative Benson.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it's a comment as much as it is a question, and it's listening and getting here a little bit late. I apologize for that. But I guess what I'm hearing is that in the diversity of the plans, it makes it more difficult, especially with changing demographics of some of these. And we already heard the concerns last session about St. Paul and Duluth, that in terms of survivability and improving the outlook for the people that depend on these, I'm hearing some assumptions through statements that it would be much easier if we moved eventually to reducing the number of plans, consolidating plans. I know constituencies of these various plans may have some issues about that. But, you know, when you look at two different plans, one that indeed would take care of the essential employees, our law enforcement, correctional, and so on, with a difference in, you know, how long they're in service before they make retirement. And then you add all the others. If we had two plans and we looked at, you know, the actuarial science and of bigger plans, the opportunities that exist there to manage those in a more efficient way as versus, you know, we look at administrative overhead and on all the things that come to mind when we look at these things. If we were to look out 5-10 years and hopes that what we've done, at least in the last couple of years, could lead to many or most of these funds getting up to a point where none of the funds would take the biggest hit in terms of combining funds. I know the taxpayers are going to get involved here. But am I hearing that eventually we need to take a look at that? I also see it from another vantage point in that I think that eventually we need to begin thinking about hybrid plans, a bigger portion of it being a defined contribution and the like. And I see the ease of that being able to happen if we have healthy plans that are being managed properly and that are consistent. And I see the issues as we look across these plans with the variables in who gets cost of living, who doesn't get cost of living, when that triggers, double triggers, and so on. So I'm hearing comments that at least lead me to believe that there's a much better way to do this. And these are political solutions. Actually, the science is there to prove that that's where we need to move. But it's having the political will, if you will, to make decisions that lead us to that. Madam Chair, that's a statement or a question, and anybody's feel free to jump in.
It's a couple of months away.
Representative Benson, we do have that on our agenda in a couple months to look at benefit plan design, and hybrid plans would be part of that.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. I think it goes to actually the conversation, not 2 months from now. And certainly I want to get into a big discussion about benefit design. I'm just thinking if we don't change the benefit, and of course I hope we do at some point, I'm worried about where we're going into the future with pension plans and being able to keep our commitments to people who have retired. But just from the sake of in the next 4 or 5 years, if we were to look at making all these things the same as they make sense. I mean, if we got two groups, again, the police and corrections folks and then everybody else, if we move in a direction through this body on legislation that makes these the same. I think that's what I heard.
Well, Representative Benson, I think that was the opinion that Mr. Burke expressed that was consistent with our principles, which is, in a sense, to maintain the integrity of the retirees' retirement by having a inflation adjustment that's consistent with inflation. And that over the years that there may have been that, but then if the returns were good, there was additional. As you can see on that last page in the first packet on page 12, there was an additional adjustment made. But during years when the plan was not fully funded, there was less of a, like the last few years, there's been a very minimal inflation adjustment because we couldn't afford it, basically. And the plan couldn't afford it, even, and that wasn't keeping the retiree whole, really. So, you know, they could complain about that, and I'm sure they have. So I do think that I don't know if we can be 100% pure with that because of the volatility of the marketplace. But it's something to talk about in terms our principles say that that's the direction we should be going, and we either should be doing that or we should revise our principles, perhaps.
Madam Chair, I would say that I think it makes sense that when we don't have the funds that we're not paying a cost of living adjustments, as much as I completely understand the situation that we put retirees in, but for the sake of the plan and the future of the plan, I think sometimes hard choices are necessary.
Representative Benson, when you talked about uniformity, then one plan could be doing well and they could do the inflation adjustment, and another plan may not be doing as well and can't afford the adjustment, and so you have a lack of uniformity. And that's probably, we could hear from the plan directors, but that could be part of the reason why some plans have had a higher adjustment than others.
And thus the additional evidence that we need to think about combining plans so that they stay uniform. My comment.
Any other questions for now from the commission members?
Are you going into testimony?
Yeah, I was going to ask the plan directors to comment on this uniformity issue, and then we have some members of the public that have signed up.
And before we do that, I would like to make a statement.
Before we hear from the plan directors?
Yes.
Go proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, I think there's a thin line sometimes for the listener when we're reviewing, as we were doing this afternoon, of what's where we are and what happened to bring us to this place. And statements of judgment. And I think there were, Representative Benson just used the word, there were some assumptions. And I'm not sure we were at assumptions, but I think there were a couple statements of judgment rather than review. But that's fine, because today we're wondering where we are. And that's the purpose of this, because we're setting the groundwork for where we're going or where we should go. And what we should be talking about for the futures of all the plans and all the retirees and all the members, active and retired, of all the plans. But I also heard that there were inconsistencies with the principles, and indeed there are. But an inconsistency does not mean inappropriate. And I also heard the words inappropriate. And I think the listener has to consider those things. And here we are today with these bills enacted, plus the 2012 bill that was enacted, which took us further away in some sense, plus the national changes in how we report things, which isn't anything to do with our principles or with any changes that were made in our legislation. It was kind of something that's being imposed on us, of how now we are going to, how state governments and city governments and township governments have to calculate how they report their values. Change in accounting, so to speak. I think it's called GASB. And so that makes a considerable financial difference. And we've gone over that before, too. But before we go past the 2010, one of the things, and I remember the first night, Senator Rosen said, the commission has never, and she's absolutely right, in all the years that I've been following the commission and I have been on the commission, the commission has not been a Democratic commission or a Republican commission. We have been the commission on retirements and pensions. Non-political, with viewpoints from everyone. And in 2010, 2009, 2010, 2011, the culture here at the legislature, the political culture at the legislature, was that of partnerships. And in the Senate and in the House and in the Legislative Commission, So it wasn't like the plan directors went away and developed something and brought it and talked to their members, active and retired, and then came to the commission, and the commission just adopted. We were all working together for a common goal. And one of the results of those common goals to make things better and to develop stability in the future was working together in a cultural, political commission tradition and passing laws. Considerably, great majorities in both bodies, the legislature, and signed by the governors in those years. And so I would like the listener that has heard the review to keep those things in mind, as well as the facts that were presented in the review.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I appreciate those comments. If there are no other comments from the commission at this time, I would like to invite the plan directors to come forward and just share with us what they feel about what Mr. Barrick has presented in terms of the history and the lack of uniformity with COLAs and other related issues.
I would be willing to move approval of the minutes as long as we
Oh, yes.
Have.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion on the minutes? I'm sure you all have reviewed them. Just make sure your name is spelled right. All those in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And that is to say we do have a quorum. Okay. And who's going first? Mr. Bergstrom.
Dave Bergstrom, the director of the state retirement.
You're on the right to me.
I'm sorry. Okay. Good. And just a couple of comments. You talked a little bit about tying the cost of living adjustment to inflation. While that in a perfect world sounds good, I think some discussion has to be around the funding of that. If you ran into a year of maybe 5 years of 5, 6, 7% inflation, you could immediately put your pension plan at risk if you did tie it to inflation. So I think there are some financial concerns there. The long-term inflation rate is roughly 3%. When we came up with the 2.5, we knew we were not providing inflation, but ultimately we have to be able to afford the benefits we have. So I think we have to be aware of the cost of that. The other thing I think in this memo that I'd like to address is there's an implication that we came up with these suggestions to sort of satisfy our constituency groups. And the reverse is actually. We, in 2008 and 2009, and I think we all wish that would not have happened, but did, and we came forward with a proposal. We worked with our boards. We then met with our constituency groups, retirees, active members. We came up with a shared approach to solution, and to their credit, they supported those.
So we garnered their support. They came forward and made some cuts to their benefits. Their reductions, and they were serious. They were worth about $6 billion. And regardless of what some people will call them, they were serious reductions in liabilities, $6 billion in liabilities. So that implication is wrong. I think you deserve credit as commission for making those changes. That took a lot of courage. Those changes did set the framework. NSRS today is about 20% better funded than we were in 2009. We're at about 86 to 87% funded. Our contribution rate deficiency has shrunk, and you should take credit for that.
And regarding uniformity, in a perfect world, maybe that would be fine, but what we all came up with proposals that we thought would fix our plan, or at least go to that. And we did that purposely in order to resolve some serious funding issues.
And there are inconsistency in contributions and formulas and many other pieces that would have to be discussed as well. So a one-size-fits-all doesn't necessarily work. And that was the approach that we took in 2010. We did it again in 2013, which we supported with the Paraclusion Fire and the State Patrol Plan. We lowered cost of living adjustments. We added another trigger, and we went through the same process. So those are just my questions.
Okay. Ms. Hackey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And echo Mr. Bergson's comments to thank the Commission for the hard work you did in 2010. You actually had a very active debate about the differences in our COLA approaches, and I remember very specifically Senator Rosen, Senator Pappas, Representative Murphy, engaging in a very specific debate about why, for example, TRA chose to freeze our COLAs for 2 years, provided no COLAs, and then leveled out to 2% COLA, which is where MSRS is as well. And PARA took a slightly different approach, a 1% COLA. And there were very good reasons. I think the memo maybe didn't elucidate the fact that we were all in a post fund prior to 2009. So all three of our systems were very consistent in our COLA mechanism because we were all in one fund, the post fund, and it was financed out of that mechanism. But because the post fund was no longer supportable financially, it was dissolved. We each absorbed our retiree liabilities into our funds. So when we came out of the 2008-2009 downturn, we were in very different financial shapes. We had different funding ratios. We had different deficiencies. TRA specifically still has a very heavy retiree liability load. So for us, we needed to front load the savings from the COLA cuts. That's why we needed a freeze to get back into decent shape. Whereas MSRS and PARA didn't need as much of a front loading of their savings, and I won't speak for PARA, but PARA has had a lower funding ratio. They needed those long-term savings from a lower 1% COLA. So you all actively debated that. We discussed what I'm just briefly summarizing here today, and I think it was a conscious understanding that we are in different financial positions. We needed different approaches to reducing our liabilities. And that's why you have the product that you have of different COLAs right now. So, again, I just want to thank you for that work back a few years ago. It was critically important to getting us back in much better financial shape than we were previously.
Okay, Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director, and I don't need to add on to what has been said, but I can tell you that it was a very difficult discussion for our Board of Trustees in 2009 in anticipation of 2010. We looked at what the other funds were proposing, and we landed at the fact that we needed to go lower for a longer period of time because we had just come out of a period of increasing contributions for our members, and we carefully discussed our fiduciary duty to our active members and to our retirees to have a sustainable plan where everybody participated in the solution. Our constituency groups supported us, I know reluctantly, but they supported us. They came to you and said, we understand we need to do this. In 2013, in the recent legislative session, our police and fire group, we had hoped to take them back to 1.5%. And when we talked to them about the impact, significant impact, of the retiree adjustment and the fact that delaying adjustments would also be a considerable help in solving the issues with the police and fire fund, they backed us. And that was an important part of it. There are many plans that delay when they pay a first increase, especially when people retire early. Mm-hmm. So our model here in Minnesota is a little more generous in giving it to them, you know, as soon as we do. And while it's been affordable in the years over time, it is now a point where we have to reconsider that and move forward with a different model. So we appreciate very much your support. We appreciate the support of our constituency groups, and we feel that the changes that you've supported have now put us in a much better place, and we feel comfortable that we can continue to work together to make sure we stay there. Questions? Okay, thank you very much for now. Are there any other plan directors here? Okay, why don't we go to the testifiers? Change here? Yes, change. Come forward.
My name's Christine McDonald. I'm the Deputy Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. I would have joined everyone, but I didn't want to bump out one of the other executive directors. And I would repeat, I wasn't in the director position at the time that those COLAs went through back in 2010, 2009. But like my colleagues at the other funds, we're very grateful to the Pension Commission in helping us support our members with the COLAs that not as rich of COLAs as they would like. We have, as somebody mentioned, we had a lot of our constituents calling and saying, well, their costs are increasing, but they're only getting 1% from the SBTRFA. And we do try to explain to them that we are looking for their long-term health of the fund, and that the contributions, increased contributions that our members are putting toward the fund are that's taking care of the active teachers, but the retired teachers have not had to share in that. And so our request for the lower COLAs in 2010-2011 were to include those individuals as stakeholders in the continuation and the full funding of the fund.
Ms. McDonald, there's one inconsistency with St. Paul teachers, which is there's no blink off if the fund goes above 80% and then you provide the 2% COLA, but then if it drops below again. And I don't know if there was a reason for that, if you recall.
That's correct.
That should be changed.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I believe at the time we wanted to see whether the changes that were put into effect would lead us in the right direction, knowing that we always had the opportunity to add that provision.
Any questions? All right,
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Johnson.
Something's been passing through my mind, and your comment made it come real to me. I look at the Pension Commission as being a group of people that are looking out for retirees and their pensions and would like to see everyone get whatever they really are deserving of. And if I would see that one group of retirees is not getting what they're due because of something that's not appropriate in their plan, or not, I shouldn't say appropriate, maybe is not done as well as it could be. There could be a better way to have their plan worked out. The one thing I could think of, you know, right off the top of my head is the method of investment. Some of the plans maybe don't have a person as talented as another plan in determining how to invest their money. That could be hard for the retirees. So I see us as looking at the plans and saying, you know, this isn't very good for your retirees. Maybe we could encourage you to do something about it. And I, again, no particular criticism at anyone, but just a reminder that since we have all these different plans, we need to be looking at all of them.
I actually, in terms of that example, and maybe someone rather than me should explain this, but the three major plans, their investment is through the State Board of Investment. Mm-hmm. And I did see Harold Bicker earlier. He'll be here tomorrow morning, so we can ask him about the investment policies. I believe the St. Paul teachers have their own investors, but their rate of return has equaled or exceeded the St. Board of Investment. And I think the Duluth plan also had their own investment managers. But I think they did quite well, too. I don't know off the top of my head. Is there anyone here from Duluth?
I am, but I don't know the answer.
But you don't know the answer? Okay. I believe, though, they did do quite well with their investment until more recent years. So, yes, Senator Representative Murphy might know.
As of June 30th, they were up 17% for 2013.
I think everyone had a really good year this last year. It was very good. So, I think that you certainly could. There are other maybe inefficiencies in having a smaller plan. There are also advantages in that you can often provide more personal service if you have a smaller plan. So, I mean, that's part of the discussion about whether Duluth and St. Paul should be merged into TRA. At what point is it appropriate to do that, and is it appropriate to do that? I know the governor is very interested in that.
Chair, if I might,
Senator Johnson.
To say that I had no thought about pointing at St. Paul or Duluth, but rather to look at it generally, and with the materials that were mailed to us by the commission, I happened to take some time and look over not just the last year, but the last 10 years and the last up to 17 years that what has been happening. And I thought some things that were, I think, noticeably kind of like, And that's not to be critical of any one particular, and you can believe it or not, but I did not have a single group in mind when I spoke
there. And Senator Johnson, the number two on the agenda is about the investment performance, and that would be a really good time tomorrow morning to ask some of those questions and bring up some of those issues.
Madam Chair, and also, I wasn't just talking about investment. I was talking about
other things,
policies,
right,
that we're talking about, how to adjust and so forth that we've heard about today.
Thinking that too. Well, I think in terms of our discussion right now, when we're talking about COLAs and what the retirees feel, is they can, and Mr. Barrick brought that up in terms of lack of uniformity, is why does this plan, why do they get a 2%, we only get a 1%, and why were we frozen? And how I see that is we also have a responsibility to look at the long-term viability of the plans. And so sometimes that COLA adjustment differs for that reason, which I think some of the plan directors alluded to that. So it's not so simple.
Some of these plans. I don't believe it's simple, believe me.
We all know that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to add a comment onto Senator Johnson's remarks here. The way that the funds invest, and I bet you if we ask this question tomorrow of Mr. Bicker, he's going to reiterate pretty much what I'm going to say, is the investment policies for the fund are prescribed in statute. Our investment mission, our investment philosophy, our investment goals are laid out in statute. As a matter of fact, in the omnibus bill that we passed this session, we did some updating to some of the different provisions of those investment policies that we have here in the state of Minnesota. As a result of that, I think you're also going to hear Mr. Bicker say that he will look at the actuarial payouts that he needs to do and invest accordingly within the realm of the state statute and with what he is anticipating the needs are going to be for the individual plans. When you have some of the retirees retiring before age 65 and being able to get slight reductions in their benefits, others being able to retire at 50, which we've adjusted to a 55-year age, I think you're going to see a lot of those things, and that's where I think we see these deficiencies. I think it has nothing to do with investment. I mean, if we look at Mr. Bicker's history over the years, he has done very well by the state of Minnesota and by these pension plans. The problem that we have is we have an unpredictable marketplace and economy and financial assets out there. And everybody would like to be able to shift from themselves that to another location or another party or another venue, and that's really kind of what's happening with the pension. And we are the oversight right now from the legislature looking at what's going to be, I think, the start of a very difficult series of years of conversations that we're going to be having to have. Before I came to the meeting today, some of the major financial websites were posting that California is going to be an even more difficulty again because of the difficulties that they have with CalPERS, and that's the state pension plan there. And so the steps that we're taking, although good, we've got to get more aggressive in that outcome. And I realize that some of that stuff tails over tomorrow, but I suspect you'll hear in Mr. Bicker's comments tomorrow many of the things that I just iterated here this afternoon.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we move to people who would like to testify, starting with Dennis Holscher. Mr. Holscher, welcome to the commission.
Madam Chair, commission members, thank you. This is my first time. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I've never spoken before a committee or commission. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota, except for my military service. I, in fact, grew up in a neighborhood halfway between this building and the fairgrounds. And my parents' families grew up in a neighborhood even closer. It's the Frogtown neighborhood. I guess you can call me a homegrown Minnesotan. Today I'm speaking as a retired deputy sheriff. I'm speaking for myself. My entire career was in the largest sheriff's office in the state of Minnesota. I worked there for 25 years. I retired 14 years ago. I retired at top-level deputy pay. I received all the increases throughout my 25 years, and I was top pay. Today, after 25 years working as a deputy sheriff and 14 years retired, my income this year in 2013 is $29,600. Current salaries for police and fire members have finally gotten to a level where they're fair compensation for the work they do. I'll give you some examples. The 2013 salaries for a firefighter in St. Paul, this is a base firefighter. This is not including overtime. It's not including special pay for paramedic or EMT or hazmat or any other extra pay. Their base pay, $68,600. A Hennepin County Deputy Sheriff Sergeant, today's top pay, base pay, no overtime, no spiking, is $82,500 and some. In Minneapolis City, a police lieutenant base pay is $95,500 and some. Over the last decade, police and fire retirees have received an average annual increase of 2%, as for the last decade, the years 2003 to 2012. Over that 10-year period, that is accumulated to a 20% behind the cost of living. In the last 10 years, people still working have had their future pension benefits calculated at 3% a year. That's 21% above inflation. We have a 20 and 21%, a 41% difference between those of us who are retired and those still working. And now the legislature in this last session has reduced our 2% to 1%. When I go to Cub Foods and buy groceries, when I go to SuperAmerica and buy my gas, or go to Target and buy other things, when I pay my house insurance, my car insurance, when I pay for my house, I pay for my car, I pay my taxes, I don't get a 20% or anything kind of a discount because I'm a retired deputy sheriff. I pay what everyone else pays. The only thing I'm asking for is you think of these things when you do your deliberations and you make your decisions. We're the veterans. We've been there. We've completed our tour. We've done what we're supposed to do. And please don't forget us. We do not want to be the forgotten veterans. Madam Chair, thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Holscher? Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Ms. Crockett.
Good afternoon. I'm Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment. And I'm going to limit my comments today pretty much to the issue before you, which is cost of living adjustments for retirees. And look forward to other discussions in the future, Madam Chair. The goal to protect public pensions against inflation with a COLA seems quite reasonable, especially if it is fully funded. But with all issues surrounding public pensions, I think it's also reasonable for you to consider how pensions and other retirement plans function in the private sector. And as you know, that's kind of a role that I take on to pop in because, you know, you were talking about the culture, Representative Murphy, of the Pension Commission, and I think it's fair to say that the commission can get into its own silo, if you will, and just look at protecting public pensions and not consider what's happening out in the private sector. So I'll pop in from time to time to remind you. In the private sector, if there is a COLA, it's usually tied to an index, which the state of Minnesota, as you've discussed, does not do. And this, in theory, protects against excessive increases in a pension if it's tied to an index. And while I'm no expert on it, I know the CPI has problems. I think that Mr. Bergstrom referred to some of those. So I'm not suggesting that there's any perfection there, but that's often what happens with private pensions to the extent that they still exist. And most retirement plans, whether they're a pension or a 401k, however, do not have a COLA. That is not something that a majority of Americans enjoy when they retire. They simply manage their own assets and personal budgets against inflation. There isn't anybody looking out for them on that. There isn't any guarantee as we have with public pensions. So before the state accepts COLAs as an accepted norm of pension policies and thus just tries to perfect them, I would ask you to keep in mind how COLAs impact the overall health of each pension fund and consider that private retirees, and that is many taxpayers, do not have a COLA at all. And I also note that the pension promises that have been made by the state over the years have not been funded, either the base or COLAs, which puts both retirees and taxpayers at risk. And as I've said to you before, with all due respect for the talent and the extraordinary effort that all of you put forth as our state elected officials, even if the Pension Commission was the only commission that you sat on or committee that you sat on, and it was a full-time effort on your part as a state legislator, again, with all due respect, I don't think you could design a perfect defined benefit system. And I know that you said, Madam Chair, that hybrids and a greater role for defined contributions would be on the agenda later in the year, and I urge all of you to consider the huge national conversation that's going on. Certainly Minnesota is not in the terrible shape that other states are in, but we don't want to get there either. And I would, again, offer, as I did last spring, to be a resource to you with studies and other policy commentary in this area and be a resource to the commission. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Are there any questions for her? Okay, thank you. I believe we'll come back to this at a later time. So, yes, Mr. Rice, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I was going to say, is there anyone else that wants to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. I represent Minnesota professional firefighters and police officers throughout the state and St. Paul teachers. Just on the topic of cost of living, I think maybe the most important chart that you've seen here in a lot of information is the one Mr. Martin referred to earlier, which shows the consumer price index compared to MSRS, PRA, TRA.
On page 12.
And there's a lot of history here, and I'd really like to piggyback on what Deputy Hochler just said. If you look at these numbers and go back 10 years, nobody has kept up with the consumer price index in the public sector. And particularly if you look at Duluth and St. Paul teachers, you'll see that they're significantly below it. And the testimony that the deputy gave you today is accurate. It isn't a criticism. I think I'm echoing Representative Murphy's comments. There is no perfection on this earth. I think the Pension Commission has tried to do so. If you rolled it back 20 years ago, you'd see you overpaid relative to the Consumer Price Index, largely because the stock market was doing well and there was a formula that generated investment returns that were in excess of the cost of living. But I would really urge the Commission, as you look at these numbers, to realize that none of these groups have exceeded the Consumer Price Index, which is not, again, a perfect measure, but it's the best one, I think, that we have. And particularly in the teacher area, Duluth and St. Paul, and TRA. You'll notice that there were several years of the zero there for Duluth and St. Paul and TRA. And if you compare their returns in each of those respective years, you'll see that they've fallen below. Likewise, you will see that with the Police and Fire Fund and PARA. And what's particularly acute about the Police and Fire Fund is this. They are not covered by Social Security. So they worked all those years. There is not an inflation adjustment. And again, with due respect to Ms. Crockett, people in the private sector do have Social Security, and there is a CPI index that's associated with that, and retirement benefits are escalated in some reasonable, measured way to keep up with groceries, gasoline, insurance. The federal employees have similar protections as well for cost of living protection. And I again remind the commission that 10% of all the employees in this state are public employees that fall under your jurisdiction. That's a significant part of the state's workforce. And as you consider dealing with those employees, it's an enormous responsibility, and this group probably has more responsibility than any other single body in the state. You're dealing with over 250,000 active employees and well over 100,000 retirees. So you have a pretty large responsibility to a large group of retired people in this state. Those people are citizens of the state. They pay taxes, and sometimes they even find their way to your doors to get support in committees other than this. And the more that I would urge the Pension Commission, as you look at this systemically, to make sure that you're caring for probably at least 10% of the state's population, you do so in a reasonable and measured way. I think it's certainly appropriate to consider the Pension Commission policy about the inflation protection. It's been a long-term part of the fabric of the Pension Commission's policies for well over 30 years. It's been there as long as I've lobbied in this building. It's always appropriate to review those, and the Commission may want to consider changing that. It's a major discussion. But I would also say, from my observation of the Commission, yes, disparities and changes have been made, but they were tough decisions. The commission, the pension fund administrators, the stakeholders looked at it, were doing their best to come up with solutions to a variety of problems. And I think, if anything, the commission should be commended for its diligence on these matters going back any number of years to try to address these problems as they come up, to get out ahead of them, to make the important changes that were made. And probably most importantly, they were made under Democratic governors, Republican governors, independent governors, with basically a bipartisan pension commission. And politics really had seldomly come into the room. I don't know that that's the case anymore. I hope that the traditions of this commission would be in keeping with prior pension commissions and prior efforts by, I remember Governor Carlson was an active participant, Governor Pawlenty, who was not known necessarily for his rhetoric might have been one thing, but I think when it came down to dealing with pension matters, he was very much in line with any of the other governors we've had, from Governor Perpich to Governor Carlson to Governor Ventura. Governor Dayton and other ones. That even Governor Dayton this last session, I think, drove a pretty hard bargain about how we're going to deal with the teacher pension issues. And it wasn't just either a rubber stamp or go one way. They always asked the tough questions. They wanted to understand how these systems worked and what was reasonable and prudent. And I think somehow the Pension Commission has got there, and there's no doubt there was a need to make corrections, and you did it, and you did it in a timely manner. And I think when you hear more about how well the investment returns are doing, there's a lot of good things to talk about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Rice? Is there anyone here from the governor's office that's following us? We should maybe call.
I do know that the person in the governor's office who usually attends is out.
And she's out this week?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'll make sure.
Okay, we still have two items left in our agenda for tomorrow morning. We reconvene at 9. And if members are not locked in stone on your schedule, we might want to stay a little bit later to make sure, like till 11:30, to make sure we get everything covered. And I'd appreciate that if people could hang with us. We may be done by 11, but I didn't think we'd take the whole 2 hours on this one item, and we did. So the meeting is adjourned. We'll reconvene tomorrow morning at 10.
Define context. Yeah, get my brain back into
focusing on this kind of stuff.
Really? No. No.
Yeah.
It seems like it blew by.
Later. Have a good day.
It's been generally busy.
But I did.